This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. A few dozen friends of mine gave me a wonderful Christmas present. They each recorded some Christmas stories for me to broadcast. These run the gamut from spiritual to funny, from touching to shocking to scary. We got some sci-fi, we've got some poetry, there are some songs and some jokes. Robin Bullock supplied the instrumental music. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
This is Fred Corlett reading Bertie's Christmas Eve by Saki. It was Christmas Eve, and the family circle of Luke Steffink, Esquire, was aglow with the amiability and random mirth which the occasion demanded. A long and lavish dinner had been partaken of. Waits had been round and sung carols. The house party had regaled itself with more caroling on its own account, and there had been romping which even in a pulpit reference could not have been condemned as ragging. In the midst of the general glow, however, there was one black unkindled cinder. Bertie Steffink, nephew of the aforementioned Luke, had early in life adopted the profession of ne'er-do-well. His father had been something of the kind before him. At the age of 18, Bertie had commenced that round of visits to our colonial possessions, so seemly and desirable in the case of a prince of the blood, so suggestive of insincerity in a young man of the middle class. He had gone to grow tea in Ceylon, and fruit in British Columbia, and to help sheep to grow wool in Australia. At the age of 20, he had just returned from some similar errand in Canada, from which it may be gathered that the trial he gave to these various experiments was of the summary drumhead nature. Luke Steffink, who fulfilled the troubled role of guardian and deputy parent to Bertie, deplored the persistent manifestation of the homing instinct on his nephew's part, and his solemn thanks earlier in the day for the blessing of reporting a united family had no reference to Bertie's return. Arrangements had been promptly made for packing the youth off to a distant corner of Rhodesia, whence return would be a difficult matter. The journey to this uninviting destination was imminent. In fact, a more careful and willing traveler would have already begun to think about his packing. Hence Bertie was in no mood to share in the festive spirit which displayed itself around him, and resentment smoldered within him at the eager, self-absorbed discussion of social plans for the coming months which he heard on all sides. Beyond depressing his uncle and his family circle generally by singing, say, au revoir and not goodbye, he had taken no part in the evening's conviviality. 11 o'clock had struck some half-hour ago, and the elder Steffinks began to throw out suggestions leading up to that process which they called retiring for the night. "Come, Teddy, it's time you were in your little bed, you know," said Luke Steffink to his 13-year-old son. "That's where we all ought to be," said Mrs. Steffink. "There wouldn't be room," said Bertie. The remark was considered to border on the scandalous. Everybody ate raisins and almonds with the nervous industry of sheep feeding during threatening weather. "In Russia," said Horace Bordenby, who was staying in a house as a Christmas guest, "I've read that the peasants believe that if you go into a cowhouse or stable at midnight on Christmas Eve, you will hear the animals talk. They're supposed to have the gift of speech at that one moment of the year."
"Oh, do let's all go down to the cowhouse and listen to what they've got to say," exclaimed Beryl, to whom anything was thrilling and amusing if you did it in a troop.
Mrs. Steffink made a laughing protest, but gave a virtual consent by saying, "We must all wrap up well, then." The idea seemed a scatterbrained one to her, and almost heathenish, but it afforded an opportunity for throwing the young people together, and as such she welcomed it. Mr. Horace Bordenby was a young man with quite substantial prospects, and he had danced with Beryl at the local subscription ball a sufficient number of times to warrant the authorized inquiry on the part of the neighbors whether there was anything in it. Though Mrs. Steffink would not have put it in so many words, she shared the idea of the Russian peasantry that on this night the beast might speak. The cowhouse stood at the junction of the garden with a small paddock. an isolated survival in a suburban neighborhood of what had once been a small farm. Luke Steffink was complacently proud of his cowhouse and his two cows. He felt that they gave him a stamp of solidity which no number of Wyandots or Orpingtons could impart. They even seemed to link him in a sort of inconsequent way with those patriarchs who derived importance from their floating capital of flocks and herbs, he-asses and she-asses. It had been an anxious and momentous occasion when he had had to decide definitely between the buyer and the ranch for the naming of his villa residence. A December midnight was hardly the moment he would have chosen for showing his farm building to visitors, but since it was a fine night, and the young people were anxious for an excuse for a mild frolic, Luke consented to chaperone the expedition. The servants had long since gone to bed, so the house was left in charge of Bertie, who scornfully declined to stir out on the pretext of listening to bovine conversation. "We must go quietly," said Luke, as he headed the procession of giggling young folk, brought up in the rear by the shawled and hooded figure of Mrs. Steffink. "I've always laid stress on keeping this a quiet and orderly neighborhood." It was a few minutes to midnight when the party reached the cowhouse and made its way in by the light of Luke's stable lantern. For a moment, everyone stood in silence, almost with a feeling of being in church. "Daisy, the one lying down, is by a shorthorn bull out of a Guernsey cow," announced Luke in a hushed voice, which was in keeping with the foregoing impression. "Is she?" said Bordenby, rather as if he had expected her to be by Rembrandt. "Myrtle is..." Myrtle's family history was cut short by a little scream from the women of the party. The cowhouse door had closed noiselessly behind them, and the key had turned gratingly in the lock. Then they heard Bertie's voice pleasantly wishing them a good night and his footsteps retreating along the garden path. Luke Steffink strode to the window. It was a small square opening of the old-fashioned sort, with iron bars let into the stonework. "Unlock this door this instant!" he shouted, with as much air of menacing authority as a hen might assume when screaming through the bars of a coop at a marauding hawk. In reply to his summons, the hall door closed with a defiant bang. The neighboring clock struck the hour of midnight. If the cows had received the gift of human speech at that moment, they would not have been able to make themselves heard. 7 or 8 other voices were engaged in describing Bertie's present conduct and his general character at a high pressure of excitement and indignation. In the course of half an hour or so, everything that was permissible to say about Bertie had been said some dozens of times, and other topics began to come to the front. The extreme mustiness of the cowhouse, the possibility of it catching fire, and the probability of it being a rowden house for the vagrant rats of the neighborhood, and still no sign of deliverance came to the unwilling vigil keepers. Towards 1 o'clock, the sound of rather boisterous and undisciplined carol singing approached rapidly, and came to a sudden anchorage apparently just outside the garden gate. A motorload of youthful bloods in a high state of conviviality had made a temporary halt for repairs. The stoppage, however, did not extend to the vocal efforts of the party, and the watchers in the cowshed were treated to a highly unauthorized rendering of Good King Wenceslas, in which the adjective good appeared to be very carelessly applied. The noise had the effect of bringing Bertie out into the garden, but he utterly ignored the pale, angry faces peering out at the cowhouse window and concentrated his attention on the revelers outside the gate. "Wassail, you chaps!" he shouted. "Wassail, old sport!" they shouted back. "We'd jolly well drink your health, only we've nothing to drink it in." "Come and wassail inside," said Bertie hospitably. "I'm all alone, and there's heaps of wet." They were total strangers, but his touch of kindness made them instantly his kin. In another moment, the unauthorized version of King Wenceslas, which, like many other scandals, grew worse on repetition, went echoing up the garden path. 2 of the revelers gave an impromptu performance on the way by executing the staircase waltz up the terraces of what Luke Steffink, hitherto with some justification, called his rock garden. The rock part of it was still there, when the waltz had been accorded its third encore. Luke, more than ever, like a cooped hen behind the cowhouse bars, was in a position to realize the feelings of concert-goers, unable to countermand the call for an encore, which they neither desire nor deserve. The hall door closed with a bang on Bertie's guests, and the sounds of merriment became faint and muffled to the weary watchers at the other end of the garden. Presently, two ominous pops in quick succession made themselves distinctly heard. "They've got it, the champagne!" exclaimed Mrs. Steffink. "Perhaps it's the sparkling Moselle," said Luke hopefully. Three or four more pops were heard. "The champagne and the sparkling Moselle," said Mrs. Steffink. Luke uncorked an expletive which, like brandy in a temperance household, was only used on rare emergencies. Mr. Horace Bordenby had been making use of similar expressions under his breath for a considerable time past. The experiment of throwing the young people together had been prolonged beyond a point when it was likely to produce any romantic result. Some 40 minutes later, the hall door opened and disgorged a crowd that had thrown off any restraint of shyness that might have influenced its earlier actions. Its vocal efforts in the direction of carol singing were now supplemented by instrumental music. A Christmas tree that had been prepared for the children of the gardener and other household retainers had yielded a rich spoil of 10 trumpets, rattles, and drums. The life story of King Wenceslas had been dropped, Luke was thankful to notice, but it was intensely irritating for the chilled prisoners in the cowhouse to be told that it was a hot time in the old town tonight, together with some accurate but entirely superfluous information as to the imminence of Christmas morning. Judging by the protests which began to be shouted from the upper windows of neighboring houses, the sentiments prevailing in the cowhouse were heartily echoed in other quarters. The revelers found their car, and what was more remarkable, managed to drive off in it, with a parting fanfare of 10 trumpets. The lively beat of a drum disclosed the fact that the master of the revels remained on the scene. "Bertie!" came an angry, imploring chorus of shouts and screams from the cowhouse window. "Hello!" cried the owner of the name, turning his rather errant steps in the direction of the summons. "Are you people still there? Must have heard everything Cal's got to say by this time. If you haven't, no use waiting. After all, it's a Russian legend, and Russian Christmas Eve, not due for another fortnight. Better come out." After one or two ineffectual attempts, he managed to pitch the key of the cowhouse door in through the window. Then, lifting his voice in the strains of "I'm afraid to go home in the dark," with a lusty drum accompaniment, he led the way back to the house. The hurried procession of the released that followed in his steps came in for a good deal of the adverse comment that his exuberant display had evoked. It was the happiest Christmas Eve he had ever spent. To quote his own words, he had a rotten Christmas.
In 16th century Germany, fir trees were decorated, both indoors and out, with apples, roses, gilded candies, and colored paper. In the Middle Ages, a popular religious play depicted the story of Adam and Eve's expulsion from the Garden of Eden. A fir tree hung with apples was used to symbolize the Garden of Eden, the Paradise Tree. The play ended with the prophecy of a Savior coming, and so is often performed during the Advent season. It is held that Protestant reformer Martin Luther first adorned trees with light. While coming home one December evening, the beauty of the stars shining through the branches of a fir inspired him to recreate the effect by placing candles on the branches of a small fir tree inside his home. The Christmas tree was brought to England by Queen Victoria's husband, Prince Albert, from his native Germany. The famous illustrated news etching in 1848, featuring the royal family of Victoria, Albert, and their children gathered around a Christmas tree in the Windsor Castle, popularized the tree throughout Victorian England. By the late 19th century, the Christmas tree had been brought to America by Pennsylvania Germans.
This is Lucinda Gainey. Reading from Stories Behind the Best Loved Songs of Christmas by Ace Collins. This story is about jingle bells. Medford, Massachusetts native James S. Pierpont had always shown a great deal of musical talent. As a child, he not only sang in church, but played the organ. As an adult, Pierpont continued to assist his father, the pastor of Medford's Unitarian Church, by working with the choirs and musicians. Around 1840, young Pierpont was given the assignment to write special music for a Thanksgiving service. As James sat in his father's home at 87 Mystic Street, contemplating his chore, through a window he watched young men riding their sleds down a hill. Bundling up to ward off the extremely cold weather, Pierpont stepped outside, caught up in the moment, recalling the many times he had also raced sleds and sleighs, sporting bands of merry jingling bells. He not only watched, but also began to root for the participants. Within an hour he was congratulating the day's winner. As he stepped back into the house, a melody came to him. While he warmed himself by the fireplace, James hummed the little ditty, feeling as if this just might be the foundation for the music his father's church program needed. Pierpont threw on his coat and trudged through the snow to the home of Mrs. Otis Waterman. Mrs. Waterman owned the only piano in Medford. When the woman answered the door, James matter-of-factly said, "I have a little tune in my head." The homeowner was familiar with James, knew what he wanted, and immediately stepped aside. As he sat down at the old instrument and worked out the melody, Mrs. Waterman carefully listened, then said, "That is a merry little jingle you have there." When he finished, a few moments later, the woman assured James that the song would catch on around town. Later that evening, Pierpont combined his jingle with his observations of the day's sled races and his memories of racing horse-drawn sleighs. Just that quickly, a legendary song was born. James taught his one-horse open sleigh to the choir at the Medford Church. The fully harmonized arrangement was then presented at the annual Thanksgiving service. Since Thanksgiving was the most important holiday in New England at the time, there was a large audience when One Horse Open Sleigh debuted. The number went over so well that many of the church members asked James and their choir to perform it again at the Christmas service. Although a song that mentioned dating and betting on a horse race hardly seemed appropriate for church, One Horse Open Sleigh was such a smash at the second performance that scores of Christmas visitors to Medford Sanctuary took it back to their own communities. Due to the fact that they had heard it on the 25th of December, they taught it to their friends and family as a Christmas song. Pierpont had no idea his little jingle would have such infectious power. He knew only that folks seemed to like his winter song, so when he moved to Savannah, Georgia, he took One Horse Open Sleigh with him. He found a publisher for the song in 1857, yet it was not until the Salem Evening News did a story about the carol in 1864 that James truly understood he had written something special. By then, the song was fast becoming one of the most popular carols in New England, as well as rushing across the man's adopted South. Within 20 years, Jingle Bells was probably the best-known caroling song in the country.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tina Vance, and I will be reading What Goes Up Must Come Down by Martha Bolton. I will never forget the Christmas we bought our sons a new swing set. My husband stayed up all night Christmas Eve putting it together. It would have gone faster, but he insisted on doing it the hard way by reading the easy-to-assemble directions. The directions were about 25 pages long and written in 4 different languages, none of which seemed to be English. The only set of instructions that bore a faint resemblance to our native tongue read as follows. Insert A into C, bypass B until step number 4, then connect G1 to D4, bringing figure 8 into alignment with J7 and overlapping M3 and P6. Adjust R5 to compensate for the 6H4 adjustment. Since it was too late in the evening to hire an interpreter, my husband tried to decipher the hieroglyphics as best he could. He wasn't totally lost, though, because he had me. Men need their wives close by whenever they're attempting to assemble anything. Who else can answer those tough questions like, "Where's my hammer? What'd you do with my screwdriver? And why can't I ever find my tools when I need them?" After they've worked until the wee hours of the morning to complete the project, who else but a loving wife would have the nerve to point out those 3 screws and 2 nuts that are always left over? No matter what the project, there are always 3 screws and 2 nuts left over. Assemble a bike, there are 3 screws and 2 nuts left over. Build a dollhouse, there are 3 screws and 2 nuts left over. Personally, I think it's some sort of sick packaging joke. In spite of the instructions and the leftover parts, my husband somehow had the swing set up and operational just before dawn broke over the horizon. It was beautiful, a monument to parental perseverance. As soon as the children woke up, we tricked them into going outside. They saw the swing set and were so excited they stayed out there playing on it for hours. Now, this story would have remained a warm, wonderful Christmas memory if it weren't for one little fact. That year, we also bought our sons their own toolboxes, each complete with a hammer, socket wrench, screwdriver, and more. While my husband and I were busy making a holiday fire out of all the empty boxes and wrapping paper, the boys had their own little project going. The swing set and the tool set together proved to be too much of a temptation, and on one of our trips outside to check on them, we discovered they had dismantled the entire thing, and they didn't even need directions to do it. All the pieces were lying in a pile in the middle of the sandbox, and the boys were standing ever so proudly next to them. It was one of those moments when you don't know whether to laugh, cry, applaud their mechanical skills, or return the tool set to the store before they knock out a wall and add a rumpus room to the house. We opted to laugh about it. Besides, Dad could put it back together again. By now, he was an expert at reading the directions. "The directions!" my husband screamed, racing to the fireplace just in time to see them swallowed up in flames. Well, the kids are all grown up now, but Dad still works on it every weekend. Now let's see, that was insert A into B and then do...
Hello, this is Gail O'Neill. I'm reading one of the parts of St. Charles by the Bay. These are a series of stories that I've written. Hope you enjoy them, and they always happen at Christmas. The faded sign was barely visible through the smoky fog. St. Charles by the Bay, it read, with an arrow pointing to the right. The white-haired man almost smiled as he turned his shiny silver Cadillac off the main highway onto the narrow side road. His name also was Charles, so the sign had caught his eye. Besides, he loved the water. Perhaps a nice stroll along the bay would be a pleasant way to end this long day. Christmas Eve it was. He had driven many miles, and his stiff, aching body told him it was time to stop for a rest, to stretch his long legs and breathe a little fresh air. He drove slowly through the little town, tears welling up in his eyes as he saw the once beautiful homes now looking so sad. Windows were boarded up, and bare wood faced the cold where paint should have been. For sale signs were everywhere.
"The whole town is for sale,"
the white-haired man mumbled. He drove down to the bay where aging houses overlooked the cold, lapping water.
"Bed and breakfasts,"
he mused.
"I'll bet they were grand in their day when people came to this little town."
The shiny silver Cadillac stopped next to the deserted bridge, and the white-haired man pulled his aching body from the warm car into the icy wind. He reached inside for his coat and muffler.
"I don't want to get sick,"
he thought.
"Bad enough being alone on Christmas Eve, but to be sick, too?"
Slowly he walked beside the bay, his tall body leaning against the wind.
"How peaceful,"
he murmured.
"But where did all the people go? Why did everyone desert this beautiful place?"
he wondered.
"Why did everyone desert me?"
he wondered. He felt very alone and very sad.
"I guess this little town was named for me,"
he decided, feeling very sorry for himself and for his little town. The fog grew thicker until the white-haired man could no longer see across the water. Daylight was waning.
"Time to go,"
he said to no one in particular. As he drove slowly through the town, heading back to the main highway, he spotted a small church. A statue of an angel with arms outstretched seemed to beckon him to come inside. He decided to stop for a Christmas prayer. The interior of the chapel was dark, lit only by flickering candles. Charles sat down on a small, rough pew, then leaned over to pull out the kneeling bench. His knees ached as he remained there for a long while, remembering all his loved ones from the past. As Charles climbed stiffly back into his car, he noticed a giant glow in the fog.
What is that?
He wondered. He followed the glow until he came to a beautiful old house framed with Christmas lights. The white picket fence surrounding the St. Charles bed and breakfast was strung with hundreds of twinkling lights that glowed in the foggy evening.
How very exquisite. There are some people who still care in this little town,
he thought. Charles decided to rest his weary body in this inviting and warm place. Only one other car was visible, an old rusted Mercedes that had seen much better days. The white-haired man hesitated before knocking on the door. It was Christmas Eve. What if he were intruding? But it was a bed and breakfast after all, and he was tired. He knocked softly, then a little louder. He heard small footsteps hurrying toward him. The heavy door, laden with a huge Christmas wreath, grudgingly opened. A young girl with long golden hair stood before him. She looked worried and afraid. Charles tried to reassure her that he was just a nice old man who needed a room for the night. Suddenly, she burst out crying.
What have I gotten myself into?
He wondered as he tried to console her. Then he heard a baby's rasping wail.
Oh, my God, what now? All I wanted was a nice, quiet Christmas Eve,
he grumbled to himself. Between sobs, the little golden-haired girl tried to tell him what was wrong. He finally managed to get the whole story. Her mother and baby brother were very ill. The only doctor in town was gone for the holidays, so her father had driven to a nearby city to find a doctor who would help them. The little girl had been left at home to take care of her mother and brother. The white-haired man's heart almost burst as he looked down upon this small, brave child.
How old are you, and what is your name, dear?
He asked. I'm 8, and my name's Margaret, but everybody calls me Maggie, she sniffled.
Well, I'm Charles,
he told her.
And I'll help you.
No longer afraid, she took Charles' big hand and led him to her mother and brother. Almost hidden in a feather bed, mother and child lay sleeping, faces flushed with fever. They stirred as the white-haired man gently touched their faces.
Hurry, Maggie. Get some cool cloths and aspirin. They're burning up.
Charles took off his jacket and rolled up his sleeves. He was needed here. He forgot about himself and his sadness. It was Christmas Eve, and he was not alone. He almost smiled. Charles melted aspirin and spooned it into the mouths of the sick mother and baby. Maggie kept cool cloths on their faces while Charles busied himself in the kitchen. In the refrigerator, he found a thawed chicken meant for a Christmas meal.
Perfect,
he thought.
I can make some soup for the family. My dear mom always fixed chicken soup for me when I was sick. Seemed to work,
he remembered. Pretty soon there was a huge pot of soup simmering on the old stove. Charles left Maggie standing on a stool stirring the soup while he went back to check on her mother and brother. Mary's eyes were blurred from fever as she tried to make out the face of the white-haired man who had come softly into her bedroom. Who are you? She asked weakly. Charles leaned down.
Don't be afraid, dear. I'm here to help you. Don't be afraid. Your husband should be back any time with a doctor. You'll be fine.
Charles went back to the kitchen. He sterilized 2 bottles for the baby. One he filled with thin broth and then cut the nipple larger. The second he filled with a mixture of water and juice. A bowl was cooling for Mary. Dinner was ready. Maggie sat on her stool, hungrily eating from her steaming bowl as Charles carried the tarnished silver tray of food into the bedroom. He carefully gave the small bottle of nourishment to the baby, then a little juice. James snuggled into his mother's arms and fell asleep again. Then Charles fed Mary. She welcomed each spoonful he tenderly fed her. When the bowl was empty, she too fell asleep. The white-haired man looked down upon mother and child and almost smiled.
Well done,
he complimented himself. Now he had questions.
Where was the father? How long had he been gone?
Back in the kitchen, Maggie had finished her meal and was rubbing her eyes.
Upstairs, young lady.
Charles followed her and tucked her into bed. He didn't mention her father. She had already been through enough today. He would let her rest. No need for questions tonight. It was Christmas Eve, after all. He listened to her sleepy prayer, which ended,
Thank you, God, for sending Charles to help us.
A tear rolled down his cheek. The house was quiet now. A soft snow had started falling. On another evening, Charles would have enjoyed settling by a cozy fire and watching it snow. But tonight he was keeping a vigil over this poor family. Remembering himself now, he realized he was famished. He brought a large bowl of soup back to the crackling fire and settled into a big easy chair. His eyes kept going to the window, hoping he would see lights coming down the long driveway. As the fire died to a glow, Charles began to nod. Everyone slept. Charles' eyes popped open at the banging of the front door. The wind caught it as John pushed it open. Both men were startled at the sight of each other. Charles hurriedly explained how he happened to be dozing by the fire. Anxiously, John looked into the bedrooms at his family, relieved that everyone was sleeping very peacefully. As John descended the creaking stairs, he could smell a delicious aroma coming from the kitchen. He pushed open the door and saw Charles dishing out a huge bowl of bubbling soup. John took off his heavy jacket and scarf, both wet from the snow, and hung them over a chair to dry. Then, thankfully, he took the hot bowl from Charles.
Ah, delicious. Just what I needed. You couldn't have come at a better time for us. You must be our Christmas angel, Charles.
Charles threw back his head and laughed loudly.
I think not. No one has ever accused me of that before.
The two men sat at the kitchen table, eating and talking for a long while. John told of his disappointing trip to find a doctor.
I'm glad our lights led you to us, Charles. You're the only bright spot in this whole day.
The two new friends took their coffee mugs and settled in front of the popping embers. Full and warm, their eyes soon closed. The snow sparkled in the morning sun and shone directly into Charles' eyes. He awoke with a start, trying to remember where he was. Had he been dreaming? No. He was here with people who needed him, and it was Christmas Day.
Presents. What can I give these people? Oh, yes.
He went outside to his car. He took out one of the bags of mixed fruit brought from Florida and a large shopping bag filled with presents meant for his nieces and nephews. He would have to take them shopping when he got back home to Boston, he decided. The sound and smell of crackling bacon met him as he opened the front door. His stomach led him to the kitchen where John was preparing a Christmas breakfast. John laughed when he saw Charles struggling with all his packages.
Charles, I haven't decided whether you're an angel or Santa Claus.
The breakfast, crisp bacon, scrambled eggs, hot buttered rolls, juice and steaming coffee, was carried into the bedroom where Mary and baby James lay snuggled in the feather bed. Mary smiled weakly at John. She was so glad to see him. John kissed her forehead. Now barely warm.
How are you feeling, darling?
He asked. I think we'll survive thanks to dear Charles, Mary answered. Not used to all this praise, Charles's pink cheeks grew pinker. It had been a while since he had blushed like that. He loved all the attention, though.
What a wonderful Christmas,
Charles thought.
Loving and being loved, giving and receiving. What a feeling. This is really the meaning of Christmas. Where have I been all these years?
But he knew. Breakfast was hurriedly eaten. Unopened presents were waiting. Charles watched nervously as each of his beautifully wrapped gifts were carefully opened. The presents were perfect. It seemed that Charles had chosen them especially for this family. Mary whispered something to John, who immediately disappeared from the room. When he returned, he too had a large shopping bag.
Oh, no,
Charles said.
Please don't give me anything. I'm satisfied with your loving hospitality. I mean that. I've never had a better Christmas.
John handed Charles the bag and smiled.
Most guests take these, but I'm giving them to you. Besides, they have your name all over them.
Curious, Charles accepted the bag. Inside was a set of white towels, hand-embroidered with St. Charles. Tears welled up in his eyes, and his dimpled chin began to quiver.
Thank you,
he whispered.
From the bottom of my heart. I can't tell you how memorable this Christmas will always be.
Then?
Time to go,
Charles told them, never one to overstay his welcome. Please don't go, Charles, they all chimed in. Maggie came over and took his big hand, then reached up to hug him. Charles' breath caught. The sobs came in spite of himself. Maggie hugged him tighter. I love you, Charles. Thank you for coming. Promise you'll come back soon. As Charles left that morning, Maggie and John watched from the frosty window as he made his way carefully to his car. He started the motor, then began to scrape the snow from the windshield. The sun glistened on the snow, creating a halo around him. Look, Daddy, Charles looks just like an angel.
He is.
John was convinced of that. The snow-covered Cadillac crunched its way gingerly down the long driveway and onto the icy street. As a white-haired man drove through the little town, it seemed transformed into a fairyland by the snow.
Not bad,
Charles thought.
But this town can be better. We'll be better together,
he decided. A smile started on his face as he began to think of all the wonderful things he could do for his little town. He rolled down the window, stuck his head out, and yelled,
"I will be back."
That smile must have frozen on his face, because it stayed there forever and ever. Amen. P.S. Don't forget what your mother said about making faces. It might freeze that way. Just make sure it's a smile. Hi, this is Gail O'Neill. This is part two of St. Charles by the Bay. It always happens at Christmas. The white-haired man was packing the last of the presents into his brand-new ruby-red Mercedes, which was dazzling in the bright morning sun. Charles had visited this car in the showroom for weeks, trying to resist its beckoning beauty. He kept envisioning himself in that roadster with the top down. Finally, he relented, leaving the silver Cadillac behind as he drove his new ride off the showroom floor. He still felt a little guilty about buying it, but it looked like the new Charles, he reasoned, bright, cheery, and full of vigor. He lovingly ran his hand over the creamy caramel-colored seats.
What a wonderful aroma! A new car with leather upholstery.
He slid behind the wheel.
Smooth,
he thought, as he backed out of the driveway. He enjoyed all the admiring glances as he drove down the street. He felt young and excited. He was headed south toward his favorite destination, St. Charles by the Bay, to be with his favorite friends for the holidays. He looked forward to seeing all the changes that had taken place since his last visit there. He stuck to his promise about helping the little town.
Amazing what a little care, paint, and elbow grease can do,
he thought.
Plus a little money, of course.
His mind wandered as the ruby-red roadster eased effortlessly in and out of the heavy holiday traffic. And Maggie, what a nice letter she had written, telling Charles how eager they were for him to come, and that there would be a special surprise for him. He was upset that they should have done anything special for him, but at the same time he was curious to see what it was. The stereo switched channels automatically until Charles heard a familiar song and he clicked the stop button on the radio. His mind raced back.
Why was that song so haunting?
A sudden melancholy came over him, and he couldn't understand why. The miles clicked along as he searched his memory for the story connected to the song. Slowly the details came back to him. Tears welled up in his eyes, and a knot started in his throat. It was ironic that he should hear that song today. If he remembered correctly, it was exactly 20 years to the day that he had last heard it. His mind flashed back. Charles didn't really want to go to the party, but his brother Jack had insisted. Charles' divorce had only been final for a few months, and he certainly didn't feel like being the eligible bachelor for all the single ladies who would inevitably attend. He just wanted to stay in his room and read a book, maybe have a glass of Chardonnay. He had moved from the big house in the country. He was tired of the lack of privacy while it was for sale. Buyers and realtors seemed to come at the most annoying times. His room in a boarding house seemed cozy for now. Plus, he was away from all the memories of the big house and the failed marriage. It was a pre-holiday affair. The OKC mansion was already twinkling and glittering with festive decorations. Charles had arrived early, as usual. He also hoped to leave early and go back to his safe domain. Jack and his wife Doris had other ideas for him, and had invited someone as his partner at the formal dinner. They knew he would be upset, so they decided to let it seem accidental that they should be seated next to each other. Just two single people invited to the same party. The place cards had been set. The guests arrived and made small talk until dinner was announced. Charles was trying to look happy. He hated for people to feel sorry for him. He also didn't like sitting next to a strange woman. He knew that he had been set up. A little frown almost made its way to his face. He managed to retain his demeanor as he greeted the guests on his left. The chair on his right was still empty.
Great,
he thought.
Maybe whoever she is, this Sandra Farley won't show.
Then he heard the doorbell. Doris rose to greet her late guest and escorted Sandra into the dining room to the seat next to Charles. His breath caught as their eyes met. Her eyes were such a pale blue that they were almost luminous against her tanned skin.
Her dark curly hair framed her heart-shaped smiling face. Charles had always favored very blonde women with a thinner frame, but he was definitely captured by those eyes. They were immediate friends, and they found themselves ignoring all the others at the table. They left the party as quickly as they felt was socially acceptable, but not without both of them thanking their hosts and truly meaning it. They drove down to the harbor, one of Charles's favorite places, to watch the holiday lights and catch up on each other's lives. They strolled arm in arm, talking and laughing, not caring about the icy wind nor the hour. The moon and stars were especially bright that night as they shone down upon the two new companions. The man in the moon seemed to be smiling at them. They sat huddled together on a cold metal bench and watched the wavy reflections as the wind whipped the water. From one of the larger boats they could hear music from a private party. Charles stood up and offered his hand.
"Would you care to have this dance with me? I'm a little rusty now, but I have done a lot of dancing in my time."
Sandra laughed as she rose to fit snugly into his arms. They danced closely, enjoying the warmth of each other. Suddenly the music seemed to get louder as a new song began. "Oh, yes," she exclaimed. "That's my very favorite song. How perfect." Their arms tightened around each other as they danced to "What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life?" Her head rested against his chest as they barely moved. The music ended while their lips met, hot, in spite of their frozen faces. The spell broke as the noisy guests began leaving the boat party. Charles came back to reality then and looked at his watch. It was almost 4:30 in the morning.
"Where did the time go? I must apologize. I didn't mean to keep you out so late. Plus, I have to be on a road trip in a few hours. I just have to get a couple hours of sleep before I start out. But I'll be back in a few days, and I'll call you. I promise."
Sandra's eyes filled with tears as he left her at her door. "Don't forget your promise," she murmured, as Charles softly kissed her goodbye. But when he returned from his road trip, he didn't call. Then he had another business trip and another. He was afraid of being hurt again. He was afraid of having a beautiful memory spoiled by reality. He was just afraid. Finally, he had a few days to himself as the holidays were actually here, and business was taking a break. As he unpacked, he listened to his answering machine, a lot of hang-ups, and then a strange voice began leaving a message. "Charles, you don't know me. I'm Sandra's sister. You know, the woman you met at your brother's party a couple of weeks ago. Well, she's very sick, and I know she would love to see you. It would mean a lot to both of us. She told me after the night she met you that you were the man she was going to marry. Please call me." His breath caught and his heart began to race. He quickly reached inside his coat pocket for a pen and pad. He played the number back again and jotted it down. The phone number turned out to be the local hospital. He asked for Sandra Farley. The voice from his machine answered, "This is Sandra's room." Charles heard only a few of the details. He was in shock as Dora explained to him that Sandra had leukemia. It had been in remission, but it had suddenly returned just before they had met at the party. Her resistance was low. After that night, she caught pneumonia, and she was admitted to the hospital a week ago. Dora said that all Sandra could think about was getting well before Charles came home. She always knew he would call. He promised, she said. Charles felt ashamed and guilty. He had always been a man of his word. He rushed to the hospital, afraid that his visit would be too late. Dora had seemed very upset and urgent.
"This was too much. Why did this have to happen?"
He was trying to get his life back together again.
"And now this."
He felt sorry for himself, then guiltily felt sorry for Sandra.
"My God,"
he realized.
"I must have caused this. I kept her out all night in that cold air."
Over and over he kept repeating,
"Please, God, let her be all right. Please, let her be all right."
Sandra was sleeping when he walked quietly into her room. Her sister Dora was by her bed. "Thank you for coming so quickly," she told him. "You just might be her cure. She was so upset about getting sick because she didn't want you to see her like this. She has thought of you constantly since you met and has talked about nothing except seeing you again." Another twinge of guilt caught at his heart. He apologized.
"I'm so very sorry. I didn't know she was sick when I met her. She seemed so lively. We stayed out all night. I must have caused this."
His sad gray eyes filled with tears. "No, no," Dora comforted Charles. "She didn't want you to know she was sick. She hoped her illness would just go away again. I knew it was just a matter of time, but she has refused to believe that, and especially now. He pulled the chair closer to the bed so that he would be close to Sandra if she awoke. The tan was gone, and the curly hair was matted into ringlets around her heart-shaped face. As she opened her eyes, they became luminous when they focused on Charles. She was embarrassed about her looks. "Dora, please give me my brush. Charles must not see me looking like this. And lipstick. I know I look so awful." He caught her hand.
"You look lovely. Just like a little girl,"
he teased her, trying to speak without choking. There was a tape recorder on her bedside table. "Dora, would you please turn the music on and let Charles and me have a little time together alone?" The song was the one they had danced to their one magical night. "What are you doing the rest of your life?" It played over and over as Charles stroked her hair and her face. He left quietly when the luminous blue eyes closed again. That was the last time he saw her. Her funeral was the next Monday. It was a cold and drizzly day. Charles did not go. He wanted to remember those luminous blue eyes as they had lovingly looked at him. He was afraid of being hurt again. He was afraid of having a beautiful memory spoiled by reality. He was just afraid. Suddenly, the combination of sun and tears blinded Charles. He saw too late that the cars ahead of him had suddenly stopped. To avoid hitting them, he quickly steered his car onto the graveled shoulder. He lost control and seemed helpless as the automobile careened down the sharp incline, racing toward a wooded area off the highway. The white-haired man lost consciousness at impact. Charles' gray eyes slowly tried to focus. He felt as if he had been asleep for a long time. Where were his glasses? And where was he? He tried to sit up, but his head was pounding. He felt like a mummy wrapped in bandages. Someone in white came into his room and leaned over him. He felt a sting, and then he drifted off to healing sleep again. The next time he awoke, he saw Maggie's worried face beside him. She leaned over and kissed his cheek. "Charles, you really scared us. We were so worried when the highway patrolman called. He found my letter in your pocket and traced our number. He somehow knew that you were headed here."
"So I'm at St. Charles by the Bay?"
Charles asked. "Yes, I'm sorry you got to see the new clinic this way," Maggie responded. "This was one of our surprises. You are our first emergency case." Charles tried to laugh at the irony, but it was too painful at the moment.
"So are you the nurse?"
he asked her teasingly. Maggie laughed. "Of course not, Charles. I'm too little. We do have a super doctor, though. That was another part of the surprise I wrote about to you. Would you like to meet Dr. Farley?" Charles replied wryly.
"Do I have a choice?"
Maggie left him, then returned in a few minutes, pulling a slim blonde woman into the sunlit room. Charles squinted in the sun's glare, trying to focus on the woman in white. Proudly, Maggie introduced the new and only doctor for the little town. "This is Dr. Sarah Farley, the best doctor in the whole world." Sarah laughed. "Well, maybe in St. Charles by the Bay at least." Charles did manage a weak smile as she came closer to his bed and took his hands in comfort. As his eyes focused, he saw blue eyes so pale that they seemed luminous as they looked down upon him. Where had he seen eyes like that before? "You had quite a lot of bumps and bruises, Charles, but it looks like you'll be fine in a few weeks. Nothing seemed serious, except the blow to your head. We decided it must have been the airbag that caused the big lump. You may have a few memory lapses here and there, but the x-rays were negative, and you should be fine. Don't worry, I'll take care of you." Charles noticed a soft British accent as Sarah spoke. "You're right, I'm from London."
"My favorite city in the whole world,"
he told her.
"I've been there many times. Why didn't I ever meet you?"
She smiled at his flirting. "Because I was here. Well, not here exactly. I had just finished medical school when I came to the United States with my parents. My uncle's daughter had suddenly died, and we came for the funeral. Father was very close to his brother, so we stayed for a long time. And by the time my parents decided to return to England, I had begun my practice. That was, about 20 years ago."
"But how did you manage to find this place, Sarah?"
Charles wanted to know. "I answered a lovely advertisement that John placed in all the major newspapers. I was tired of big city life. I was looking for a quiet, quaint spot to do some good work. When I came for the interview, I fell in love with this town and John's family. I knew immediately this was my destination. I've been waiting to meet you. I just didn't realize that you had been my first patient here. They also told me in confidence that you were the saint in St. Charles by the Bay. This revival of the town was your doing. And don't be angry that I was told. I know you wanted to remain anonymous, but I was very inquisitive. They told me how wonderful you are, but they failed to mention the dimple in your chin and those long eyelashes, she finished on a light note. How could he be angry? He had looked around every corner all of his life for someone like her. She squeezed his hands. You get some rest now. John and Mary will be coming to see you later today. They've been dealing with your poor car and the insurance company. The paperwork had just reached their office from the purchase, and then the accident occurred. It will get worked out. John will see to it. For once in his life, the white-haired man had to be content to let himself and his business be taken care of by others. He thought to himself,
it's not too bad.
He relaxed in the warmth of Sarah's luminous eyes and her soft touch. He felt like he was home. And for once in his life, he was not afraid of being hurt again. He was not afraid of having a beautiful memory spoiled by reality. He was just not afraid. As he drifted off to healing sleep again, he thought he heard a familiar song coming from a new sound system. What was that song? And where had he seen eyes like Sarah's?
Enough questions. Just enjoy it,
he said to himself. As his eyes closed, one of his favorite sayings came to mind.
O God of second chances and new beginnings, here I am again. How very appropriate. Dear God, if this is a dream or reality, or even heaven, whatever it is, just let me stay here.
And he did, very happily, forever and ever. Amen.
This is Lucinda Gainey, reading from Stories Behind the Best Love Songs of Christmas by Ace Collins. This story is about Silent Night. In 1817, 25-year-old Joseph Moore was assigned to the position of assistant priest at St. Nicholas Church in Oberndorf, Austria. A lover of music since his boyhood in Salzburg, Moore was placed in charge of the music used at the small church, and he even wrote poems and song lyrics for special services. A seemingly tireless and giving man, he spent much of his spare time ministering to children from the area's poorest families. In his desire to serve and inspire, if ever a man fulfilled the full description of the word pastor, it was Moore. In 1818, during a particularly cold winter, Moore was making last-minute preparations for a special Christmas Eve Mass, a service he had been planning for months. Everything from music to message was in place. But as he cleaned and readied the sanctuary, the priest encountered an unfathomable dilemma. St. Nicholas's organ wouldn't play. A frantic Moore struggled with the old instrument for hours, making adjustments, fiddling with keys, stops, and pedals, even crawling behind the console to see if he could find a problem. In spite of his efforts, the organ remained silent, its voice as still as a dark winter's night. Realizing he could do nothing else, the priest paused and prayed for inspiration. He asked God to show him a way to bring music to his congregation on the year's most meaningful day of worship. Moore would find the answer to his prayer born from events initiated almost 2 years before St. Nicholas' organ played out. In 1816, while assigned to a church in Marsfar, Moore had written a Christmas poem. The six unadorned stanzas were inspired on a winter's walk from his grandfather's home to the church. Though he had shared the words with a few friends, the priest never sought to have the work published, nor attempted to come up with a melody to go with his words. When Moore was transferred to the church in Oberndorf, he had brought the poem along with his few personal possessions. Digging Stillig Nacht, Heilig Nacht from his desk, Moore read over the words 2 years later. Up until that moment, the verses hadn't seemed very important to the priest. But as he read them again, it was as if the Lord was tossing him a lifeline of hope. Buoyed by new and unfolding expectations, he shoved the worn paper into his coat pocket and rushed out into the night. Only hours before the Christmas Eve midnight mass, the priest fought his way through snow-covered streets. On that same evening, 31-year-old schoolteacher Franz Gruber was struggling to stay warm in his drafty apartment over the schoolhouse. Though he had once studied organ with noted teacher George Hardobler, he now played the instrument only for St. Nicholas's modest services. As he went over notes from one of his lessons, Gruber must have been surprised to hear an insistent knock at his door and find Father Moore on the other side. By that time, the priest should have been at the church preparing for services, not making rounds visiting old friends and colleagues. After a quick Merry Christmas, the obviously agitated priest pulled the teacher to the apartment's small table and signaled for Gruber to sit down beside him. In a distressed tone, Moore explained the problem they faced. After he convinced Gruber nothing could be done to fix the organ, Moore showed Franz his poem. "Franz," he begged, "can you write music to these words that can be easily learned by our choir? Without the organ, I guess the song will have to be played on a guitar." The priest glanced at the clock on the table and added, "The time is so short." Studying the poem, Gruber nodded his head. The look in his eyes and the smile on the schoolteacher's face showed that he felt up to the challenge, confident again that God somehow had a special plan for this Christmas Eve. Moore raced back across the snow to the church, leaving Gruber alone with his thoughts, a ticking clock, and a prayer for inspiration. A few hours later, the two friends met at St. Nicholas. There, in a candlelit sanctuary, Gruber shared his new music with Moore. The priest approved, and after learning the guitar chords, rushed it to the choir members, who were waiting for their scheduled rehearsal. What should have taken weeks was accomplished in hours. In the little time they had, Moore and Gruber taught the choir members the four-part harmonies to the last two lines of each verse. Just after midnight, Moore and Gruber stood in front of the main altar and introduced their simple little song. As they sang, they couldn't have guessed that Stillig Nacht, Heilig Nacht would be remembered not only the next Christmas in their small village, but almost 200 years later, around the world.